When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous, and in today's episode, infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me as always, Brian Reese.
Happy Superb Owl Day, Paul.
Superb Owl Day? Is it the big game? Oh, we really should. I really shouldn't be dating this.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
That's all right.
That's right, because you're not going to post it for like another 2 months.
I'm trying, man.
Dude, you're doing all the hard work. That is not a criticism. That is you're doing better than I would trying to keep up with this. So I was meaning that as a joke. But all of this will be cut. Do we want to try this again?
No. We'll keep going. We got to plow through.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Today on the program, it's a tale as old as time, a song as old as rhyme, Beauty and the Beast. But not that one. We're going to read the when was it? 1984 that this thing happened.
Well, it was December 84, so mostly 1985.
Eh, whatever. We'll talk about Beauty and the Beast by Ann Nesenti and whoever the artist was. Can't remember.
John Perlin.
But first, we're going to talk about a failed live-action movie project from the late 70s and early 80s that ties in sort of with what we'll be talking about today. And it would have been the origin of the MCU had it gone through as planned.
Oh goodness gracious.
Yeah, it would have been the very first Marvel movie released.
Wow. I'm stunned.
Well, are you dazzled?
I am dazzled by the concept that this would be the first MCU movie.
Well, that would, of course, it was Dazzler the movie. What do you know about this project, Brian?
Well, it was supposed to happen, and it potentially would have had Bo Derek.
Mm-hmm.
As Dazzler, and it was going to be disco-centric.
Oh, yes.
Also featuring Kiss, I believe, during their disco.
I have some relevant information that I will impart to you. Okay.
We like relevant information because that's not something we traffic in a lot.
No. We're not just making this up off the cuff. This is actual facts, people. In 1979, there was an attempt at a cross-promotion between Marvel Comics and Casablanca Records. Is it Casablanca? I'm going to say that again. And Casablanca Records. Casablanca was really big into disco at the time. You know, that was kind of their bread and butter. And there were plans, big plans, for creating a character called the Disco Queen. Yes. Who was later renamed Dazzler. Okay. And this was going to be turned into a feature film starring actual human beings and released in actual theaters, but it never actually happened. Now, this is one of those things in entertainment history that I really, really, really wish had actually happened and that it actually existed, because it would have been simultaneously the worst thing ever made and the greatest thing ever put to film.
Of course, yes.
Okay, so yeah, this was a project spearheaded by Jim Shooter, and he originally wanted Harlan Ellison to write the script. But it turns out Harlan Ellison is difficult to work with.
I am surprised to hear that.
Yeah. Coming from Jim Shooter. Wow. that would have been like Harlan Ellison and Jim Shooter working together would have just been the epicenter of awful.
Comedy gold right off the bat.
Yeah. So anyway, Ellison did not join the project, and Shooter wrote the treatment himself in a whopping 4 days. So, you know, it was some quality work.
Right.
Now, to be fair, it was just a treatment and it wasn't an actual script. It was just sort of something. Yeah. To be fair to Jim Shooter. So the story is, or was, in broad strokes, Dazzler, the Avengers, and Spider-Man would all be transported to a dystopian future New York, as opposed to New York in the 1970s. Which was fairly dystopian in all itself. And they would be dropped into the middle of a war between the Witch Queen and the Queen of Fire. Now, there was a prophecy stating that only the Sun Queen could save the world from Lord Chaos. Are you following all this?
I love comics.
I know. And Dazzler would, of course, end up being the Sun Queen and would save the world, and everyone would be sent back to the present. So, as far as a movie, right, just the...
Cher was supposed to be one of these characters, right?
Yeah, we're going to get to it. All right, I was going to say, just as a premise, that would be a great movie, in my opinion. But here's what makes it just, it just makes it 70s gold.
Chef kiss.
Yes. Bo Derek was signed on to play Dazzler. She actually was, you know, she was like officially cast as Dazzler. Or had agreed to be in the movie had it happened.
In principle.
In principle, yes.
However that wacky Hollywood stuff works.
Exactly. The Witch Queen would be played by Cher, and the Queen of Fire, Donna Summer. This is great. Kiss.
Yeah.
Kiss would play Kiss in full makeup and, you know, full on Kiss regalia would play
disco era Kiss.
Yes, would play the Dead Knights, who I couldn't figure out if they were the Witch Queen's minions or the Queen of Fire, but they would be one of the Queen's, you know, minions, the bad guys. They're the Dead Knights. The Village People would play the Stompers, who were the other, the opposite minions. Okay, so let's just get this straight. Bo Derek, Cher, Donna Summer, the Village People, and Kiss. Okay.
And this was all supposed to tie in right to a Marvel comic.
Right. But wait, there's more.
Oh!
Dazzler's love interest would be a character called Tristan, played by Robin Williams. This is Mork and Mindy era Robin Williams. This is like full on cocaine Williams. And then the comic relief character would be played by Rodney Dangerfield. And that character's name was Dewey Cheatham. And how? I'm telling you, simultaneously the worst thing ever and the greatest film in history. I am so sorry that this does not exist. What are your initial thoughts on that whole, scenario?
I mean, there's part of this that screams 70s, right?
Oh, yeah.
Late 70s. I mean, it just is, you know, it just, Hollywood, and we're going to get into Hollywood a little later.
Yes.
Because this all ties into our discussion later. It's just the level of excess, and you read about this all the time. But the fact that this was supposed to be tied in, this was going to be a crossover event where, you know, this is one of the this is one of the very original sort of Marvel taking on. It's not the original, but you know, it's another example of Marvel trying to like cozy up to Hollywood, right, and do these cross promotion things. And I mean, we can only speculate, right? And that's the thing. We like if this movie had been made, I mean, the level of just insane spectacle, and you know, it would have been terrible. It would have been.
Oh yeah, it would have been awful, but it would have been great.
But you know, I mean, this is the it feels like, I mean, this is a movie that we would be watching today.
Yes,
and it would be shown at midnight in theaters.
Absolutely, and you know, the movie would be intense because it's nothing but camp. Thank you, everyone. I'll be here all week.
You're gonna have to give people a minute to work that one through.
There was a slew of movies that came out right around this time, like Xanadu, and or even Flash Gordon. You know, look how camp that is. Yeah, we don't need to do that.
Oh, we do.
Yeah, and do you remember what was it called? It was the Village People movie with Bruce Jenner, with Caitlyn Jenner actually. Can't Stop the Music. Do you remember Can't Stop the Music?
Oh right. Well, don't forget, what is it? Phantom of the. What's the Kiss movie?
Oh.
I want to say Phantom of the Park. That's not right. But
yeah, Phantom of the Amusement Park is what I keep thinking.
Right. We know which one, you know, but yeah, you know, because Kiss did do their movie.
Yes, and there was a Kiss Marvel comic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because this was at a time when Marvel was just doing anything they could to cross-promote. You know, it was saying, we did Godzilla.
They had the Star Wars.
They had Godzilla. They had, all kinds of stuff, which I'm blanking on right now, but they tried to do everything. Micronauts. Remember Micronauts?
Right. And then eventually with G.I. Joe, and this is, you know, a few years later, but G.I. Joe and the Transformers.
Exactly. Yeah, they were trying to just whatever and however they could. We had toys, movies, TV, anything.
You had the Avengers comic where they showed up on Dave Letterman.
Exactly. Yeah, this just would have been the height of disco excess. I just so wish this existed.
But I think also one of the best parts about this is that, you know, they just decide, well, we created this Dazzler character. Let's just keep using her.
Well, that actually ties in to what we're going to talk about today, because Jim Shooter, when all this fell apart and they realized it's not going to happen, Shooter wrote Dazzler the movie, the graphic novel. That's not what it was called. It was called Dazzler the movie. And in that, it's the aftermath. I'm sure you haven't read that.
I know. I did read it in preparation for this. I read it.
Oh, you
once.
Did? Yeah. So that's kind of in the aftermath of the movie project being canceled.
Right. And yeah. So, you know, so that happened. And of course, that led into Beauty and the Beast.
So
which conveniently enough,
we're talking about today in just a few moments. So, yeah. So, you know, that graphic novel is actually, it's not good, but it's interesting in the fact that Jim Shooter, you know, kind of took inspiration from the failed movie project and then weave that into the continuity of the comics. Because I saw reference to other comics at this time, which would all either have Dazzler the movie posters behind them.
Right.
Or someone would mention, oh, I heard that movie's not going to happen. You know, so the failed crossover movie project in real life became part of the comics continuity.
Yes.
Which is fascinating.
Right. I mean, it is an interesting... What Marvel was up to in this time period was very interesting. And this is kind of like the glaring biggest example of it, right? In some ways. I mean, and because not only did this this failed movie project lead to the graphic novel and then lead to our topic for today, but it also bled into, and I'm going to cover this a little bit in my intro coming up soon, other aspects of the Marvel Universe throughout the 80s. And one could say that this failed movie project lit the fire for the X-Men in the entire 80s.
Okay, that's worth a discussion. I could see your point, but I think Chris Claremont would have issues with you.
Well, yeah, he would.
Yeah, but...
And since he's listening, Mr. Claremont, please feel free to...
yeah, message us, please. Yeah. That'll be an interesting point of discussion when we come back from our break. That was a nice segue into, we should probably take a break.
All right.
Let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a comic that was definitely published.
It was most certainly a thing that did exist.
The Swamp, more than merely a place. It is a churning, seething, bubbling bed of life of which you are a part. Once you were a man, a chemist named Ted Salas, until one little experiment went somewhat awry. And you changed. The serum that was to have made you a super soldier combined with the strange forces in the swamp to make you over into this, a shambling, mindless mockery of your former humanity. The macabre Man-Thing.
Man-Thing was created in the early 1970s to capitalize on the growing monster craze, but under writer Steve Gerber, it became something quite different. Experimental, surreal, and very, very weird. It was something I loved as a kid, but does it still hold up today, 4 decades after its initial publication? So join me, Paul Matthew Carr, as I attempt to make sense of this cult classic and analyze each issue, putting it in the context of the time it was written and comparing it to the standards of today. And maybe you, too, can come to love the world's second most famous swamp-based comic book character as much as I do. The Nexus of All Realities, a Man-Thing podcast, a twice-monthly dive into the bizarre. And we're back. Brian, you recommended this for some reason. Tell us why.
I sure did.
Tell us all about it.
History is a story. It is a story told by victors and losers alike. Mighty deeds and epic failures, the march of innovation and technology, the rise and fall of civilizations, and even the small moments of individual achievement and perseverance. History is a story that is written and recorded, from oral history to florid prose. History is a story that is represented by a myriad of visual arts, paintings, cave drawings, film, etc. History is a story passed down and changed as each generation contextualizes and interprets based on the experiences of those who would decide the representation. Art, all art, is integrally entwined in the telling of history's story. We learn who we are and who we have been and who we will be from the representation of history. It is the story of all of us. In 1985, with the publication of Beauty and the Beast, history officially died. Written by Anne Nesenti with art by Don Perlman, Beauty and the Beast was a four-issue limited series published by Marvel Comics. Ostensibly spinning out of the aforementioned Dazzler the Movie graphic novel and falling squarely in the midst of the anti-Muti craze that was sweeping through and sucking the life out of Marvel's 1980s output, the powers that be decided that the world needed a love story between a disco-singing mutant and a beloved blue fur mutant, best known for acrobatics and hilarious repartee. Sounds golden, right? This is a terrible comic book. The plot is simple enough. Beast and Dazzler meet cute and fall in love. Dazzler is manipulated and drugged by bad guys, forcing her into an underground gladiator show featuring mutants. Beast tries to save the day. He kind of succeeds with the help of other D-list mutants. Dr. Doom makes an appearance because, of course, Beast and Dazzler break up. In the course of the story, we also get creeper tendencies, emotional and physical abuse, male gaze art, ham-fisted writing, cultural appropriation, blackface, and mind-bogglingly bad plotting. We do, however, get great covers by Bill Sienkiewicz. So there's that. Beauty and the Beast isn't just weird bad. It's bad on so many other levels. The noble march of art as a shining light of historical telling and as a lighthouse for understanding our world screeches to a horrible end. It is a blue-furred beast in the rain, soggy and deflated. Hopefully we can find, in our discussion, some humorous way of discussing this turkey of all turkeys. So, Paul.
Yes, sir.
Do you have thoughts and feelings on Beauty and the Beast?
Well, in keeping with the old adage, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. I'm going to stay silent for the rest of this episode. And I, of course, that's not what I'm going to say. I am actually, when we get into this, I'm going to attempt to defend not the comic, or at least not the comic as a whole, but there are certain aspects I wish to defend or do okay. A kind of redemptive reading a bit, because there are some interesting ideas in this. But the first thing I need to say is I have nothing against Anne Nesenti. She's great. She is.
I have been a huge fan of hers.
Yeah. She's written great things. She's a filmmaker. She's been an editor. I cannot have more praise for Anne Nesenti.
She had a great run on Daredevil.
Absolutely. Even at this time, her long shot mini was pretty good.
Right.
As I recall. Now, I haven't read that in many years, but so I'm not going to say anything bad about her, with the exception of this comic is, woof, there are some choices made that I'm just thinking maybe she wants to take them back. Yeah.
One thing I didn't say in this intro, there were a couple things, maybe some caveats or whatever, you know, to start off with. We come into this, and the Beast was one of my very favorite characters in Marvel. I mean, he was an X-Men. He was an Avenger. He was a Defender. When this came out in 1985, I was 13 years old, and I was excited because I was like, oh, my God, one of my favorite characters gets his own, you know, series, and he gets the girl.
Does he? By any means necessary, apparently.
Well, yeah. And I've had some complaints about how the Beast has been treated in recent years. And then I read this, go back and reread this, and I was like, ooh, I think the way they were treating him goes back a bit further than I thought.
I was going to, that's actually one of my notes, to say, you know, you're constantly, not constantly, you talk occasionally about how Beast is done dirty. In recent comics, I believe he's been done dirty forever since the character was created. Or I guess a better way to say it is he's been written inconsistently.
Yes.
Through various iterations. Because I don't know what the character of Beast is in this. He's sort of smart guy, but he's quippy. and then he's just straight up stalker.
Like creepy.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's bizarre how that character is written. To say Dazzler is inconsistent, I have no idea. Has Dazzler ever been consistent?
You know, I have not followed Dazzler as a character in any way, shape, or form. I think she's had her moments. I mean, she clearly has been used as a character many times since this.
Yes.
She had her own series, I believe, for a while in the, what, late 80s, early 90s?
Yeah. She was a member of A-Force when that was going on a few years ago, and was used very well in that. But
and her power is kind of awesome, right?
I guess so.
She uses music to write sound to create light. You know, I mean, that's actually, it's kind of a creative, I mean, it's based on, you know, I mean, as we talked about her before, I mean, the idea that, you know, she's a musician. And of course, you know, when you see like the big super concerts, you know, with the big light shows and stuff, the light is, you know, key to the music and the changes in the music. So she's kind of a living embodiment of that sort of idea.
Yes.
It's basically everything punk rebelled against.
Exactly. Yeah, no, she is the living embodiment of disco. and she can occasionally shoot lasers out of her fingers.
Right.
Sort of, kind of. Now, everyone's powers in this is, I don't know, vague and undefined to me. You know, I mean, we'll get into it. But there's several characters in here. And like, so what is it you do? I know what the aftermath is, but I don't know how we got there. And speaking of how we got there, Brian, what is this story about?
That's the thing, right? Like, yeah. At the end of the day, we're modestly intelligent individuals, right? I mean, you know, we have some background in being able to interpret stories and to break them down. You know, it's, we both have degrees in
arty stuff.
Yeah, so it's, but both of us are sort of at the end of this, what is this story about?
Okay.
Yeah,
it's a bizarre romance. It's because it's kind of drawn like a hypersexualized romance comic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with an excess of domineering maleness in it. It is toxic masculinity.
It's the epitome of toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
From everyone, including Beast.
Yeah, which is unfortunate. Okay. And we'll get into, like I said, there's a couple of things that I think are really interesting, and I will praise this comic for. And one of them is that it starts with Dr. Doom. Because if you start something with Dr. Doom, that's going to be good.
It's got to be great, right? I mean, yeah. The fact that the powers that be allowed Dr. Doom to be in the comic. So, you know, yeah, it's Dr. Doom. He's going to be a major player in this, right? I mean, because it's Dr. Doom. You know, he's one of the great villains of comic book history. So when you start with Dr. Doom, my goodness, I mean, you're got to have, you're in the heavy hitter world here. And he's going to have a major impact on this story, right?
You'd think. I even texted you when we first started reading this. I texted you to say, hey, it's got Doom in it. How bad could this be? Well, Doom stopped being in it for long stretches of time.
Except for a few panels where he just kind of paces around and emotes about to the plot, right?
Yes.
One of the bad guys. And at the end of the day, there's no nuance. There's bad guys and... I
would dispute you on that. There is kind of nuance in that because Horseman and Green Girl are sort of nuanced.
Horseman and Green Girl.
Yes.
Technically Ryder and Ivich, I think, but Horseman and Green Girl works well. But no, I mean, Doom just kind of, he does a lot of pacing around and... I'm spoiler alert. He shows up at the end.
Yes, he's Chekhov's dictator.
And yes. Oh, nice. he shows up at the end, watches everything happen, and then kind of walks out and scolds his son and then walks away.
Yes, he does, in a very Doom fashion, scolds his son.
So spoiler alert, one of the big bad guys is Doom's son, which is why Dr. Doom is involved at all in this. It's because he's watching this guy that pretends to be his, or is saying that he's his son. And I think we kind of are led to believe it actually is. But, you know, so Doom is like, oh, I've got this kid out there who's doing some stuff and he wants my throne. He shall not have it because I am Doom.
I think Anne Nesenti actually gets Doom's voice right in this.
Right. Oh,
he's
sure,
like,
yeah.
Hey, foolish, puny person, Doom does not like this. And I mean, I kept thinking, can we please go back to Doom yelling at his butler again? Because that's awesome. Doom just, you know, he paces around his room and he screams at his butler. He doesn't scream. He talks menacingly to his butler.
Right.
And that's the most enjoyable part of this comic, I think.
Doom being Doom.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that he has no consequence in the story.
No, he measures out a scolding like nobody's business.
And that's the climax, is Doom scolds.
Yes, a Doom scolding. Should we go through the actual plot? Because there is a plot. There is.
Well, there is a plot.
Things happen in this comic.
Yes, there is a sense of forward motion. So the weird thing is, okay, so Dazzler, right, Alison Blair, and so this is part of the anti-muni thing. She's kind of a person non grata in some ways in Hollywood because she's come out as a mutant and everybody's against mutants. And so she's having a hard time finding work. And so she gets kind of coerced, manipulated, toxic masculinity'd into signing on with this Hugo Longride. Really? Hugo Longride? And Alexander Flynn, who is supposed to be Doom's son. So these two cats who are right out of central casting in terms of skeevy bad guys manipulate her into signing a contract to join their underground mutant gladiator fights that are attended by the Hollywood elite, right? And QAnon would have a heyday with this, right? I mean, because it is, when you see these underground gladiator fights with these mutants, it's all of like these skeevy, tuxedo, drunk Hollywood types, you know, screaming for blood and, you know, whatever, who are showing up to watch these gladiator fights. And it's represented as these are the very worst of humanity. Right. So Dazzler gets pulled into this world. In the meantime, our ever-loving, happy-go-lucky Beast, you know, bebops into Hollywood to visit his good pal, Wonder Man.
Well, I mean, it is it's not contrived. Wonder Man does. He is an actor.
He is an actor, and he's on the West Coast now. And so Beast meets up with his good buddy, Wonder Man. And, you know, while Beast is in Hollywood, of course, he runs into, you know, he's just dippy-dooing around, you know, Hollywood and seeing all these movie stars and whatever. And, you know, I think Spielberg's name is mentioned maybe 50 or 60 times in this comic.
Yes. There's also a panel that has Vincent Price and Indiana Jones.
And there's also Marilyn Monroe is wandering around Hollywood at this point as well.
Yeah. Yeah. To be fair, I think they're supposed to be impersonators on the street. So,
mm-hmm. So Beast gets Wonder Man takes him to a Hollywood party, and there Beast meets Alison Blair, Dazzler, and he is dazzled by her.
And immediately announces himself to be her boyfriend.
Right, he gets into like a fight with Horse Guy. Horseman,
yes.
The Horseman. And, you know, defending Dazzler's honor. And apparently they have met before. They established that they have met before in the past doing their superheroing.
Yeah.
But, you know, so then he proceeds to start stalking her. Meanwhile, Wonder Man disappears completely.
Yeah, says, "I've done my introductions. I'm out. Bye." He becomes Wonder Man,
right? And so with everything that happens later, right? Beast can't just call up his best buddy, who is just, you know, lives a mile down the road, to help out with all of the things that happen later.
Yeah, and he's got Hollywood connections, so you think that would be a good, you know, good resource to use. It should be noted at this point too that we find out that Dazzler's powers are kind of going out of control. She can't hold them back anymore, and she's starting to get a little freaked out about that.
Because she's partly because she's being drugged.
Exactly, she's being drugged, and Doomson, Alexander Doomson, he actually has empathic powers to make people believe what he wants you to believe.
Right.
So it's a combination of her being drugged and her being mentally controlled. So that's going on right now. And that's a little, you know, that's happening under the main story as well.
So at some point then, Dazzler and Beast end up at the Heartbreak Hotel.
I thought that was just going to be a nickname. Like they were just going to call it the Heartbreak Hotel. And then there's a sign. It's like, oh, no, it's actually called the Heartbreak Hotel. Look at that.
For some reason, they end up there. Their romance blossoms. Now, the Heartbreak Hotel is run by this woman, Kate, who's a mutant, but she's a non-practicing mutant.
Yeah. No, I like that. She says, I'm an old lady, and now I just hang out and be with my hippie tendencies. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is my second of what little praise I'm going to give to this comic. I like the idea of the Heartbreak Hotel.
Sure. She takes in...
Wayward mutants.
But, we have that, you know, what's the... In the X-Men, the underground Callisto,
they're the...
You're the expert. You're the X-Men expert.
I am not the X-Men expert.
But yeah, you know, you have the underground mutants in New York or whatever with the...
Yeah, with Callisto. So,
this is a kinder, gentler...
Yeah, this is just sort of like, you know, it's a nice, safe place for them, for mutants to go and just kind of get their head together, man. Okay.
And we only see really three of them. There is a woman who changes the color of flowers.
It's nice.
Yeah. And then there's Poltergeist. They're kids. They're younger kids. There's Poltergeist, who is either the Poltergeist or the Poltergeist is haunting him and, you know, whatever. But he can't control his powers. And so things happen. And he just wanders around in his pajamas for the entire comic book.
Now, Poltergeist should be noted that he's actually a character from Anna Senti's Spider-Woman run. Which is mentioned a couple of times in there.
Which they reference a few times with the editor's notes and whatever. I've never read that. So he's there in his pajamas. And then there is another young mutant named Link, who is Harlequin, right? And can change his face.
Yeah. See, and this is what gets to, what are these powers exactly?
Yeah, and I still am unsure, but somehow we find out later his powers are able to help Poltergeist, whose powers are out of control. Link is somehow able to calm the Poltergeist. And to be honest, and you were talking about things that are positive about the series, the relationship between Poltergeist and Link, I think, has a subtext that is actually kind of positive.
Right. Yes. No, I agree.
I don't want to read too much into it, but I think Nocenti was maybe doing a thing that you couldn't say out loud.
Right.
In mainstream comics at the time, that I think is one of the few positives I take from this, is what I think is a friendship between these two young mutants that maybe is a little bit more than friendship. I am reading into this, but I think,
yeah, there's definitely subtext there, for sure.
Gives enough there that, and any kid reading that part of the story and seeing that, who knows the subtext, would get it.
Exactly.
And it's the representation is very positive.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think, like, there is a message here, or a theme, I should say. And that is to be happy with who you are. And right, not to let what others think about you determine what your life should be. And it's about, you know, to put it plainly, it's about pride and identity and self-identity.
Right.
And now that message gets lost in a pile of steaming stuff. But it is there. So I do think that there was, I mean, there, like I said, it has good stuff in it. I think it has good ideas buried in this pile that is this comic. I wanted to say something about in the narration for Heartbreak Hotel, when we first get it, there's something I read, and I wrote it down because I think it's great. And it says, they are the uninvited, the feared, giving themselves over to fortune. Perhaps if tossed about on the seas of fate long enough, they will find some chance of peace. But for most, peace is a dream that they'll never touch on these shores.
See, now that's good Anne Nesenti writing.
Exactly. And if this whole comic was just Anne Nesenti narration, it would be a classic. And there's little bits of that peppered through. Like when we first meet the gladiatorial ring, and when it's all over, someone dies in it, which, you know, someone is killed in the ring, and all the people are cheering and cheering. But then when they leave, Anne Nesenti makes sure to say, you know, they can't look each other in the eye. They're ashamed of what they have done, even though they're exhilarated by it.
Right.
And again, that's good Anne Nesenti writing. And then stuff goes away.
I think the creators walked away from this and couldn't look each other in the eye.
Right.
For what they had done.
Yes, it's very meta.
Maybe I'm being a little hard. No, I don't think I'm being overly harsh, because we haven't really hit all the bad stuff in this yet, because I think we're trying to find good stuff. And we were talking about the plot, and I think so Dazzler and Beast, to pull ourselves back a little bit, Dazzler and the Beast end up at this Heartbreak Hotel. We meet these kids. There's some positive stuff here, like we just pointed out. But somehow Dazzler keeps still going back to this gladiator pit, and the gladiator pit is weird. So it's, you know, it literally is just mutants being pitted against each other in a fight. And at one point they're telling, you know, Dazzler that, oh, it's just for show. And then somebody dies. And then they're saying, well, that really happens. And then maybe it doesn't happen. And then the motivations and characterizations of a lot of these people are all over the place.
Yes.
Like Horseface Rider and Green Woman, you know, it's at one moment they're just terrible and they're on board with all of this. And then suddenly they're not.
Yeah. And Horseface is set up in the beginning to look like he's sort of like this criminal, you know, lackey who's going to be doing bad things. But then he's sort of the hero, not the hero, but he's, you know, he has a heroic streak in him.
He has a redemption arc at the end.
Yes.
But the redemption arc comes from no motivation and there's no learning curve. There's nothing that leads to that other than one minute he's this and then the next minute he's that. And you're like, you're throwing your arms up in the air going, where did that come from?
In addition to where did that come from, Beast at one point wants to track down where, because Dazzler has left at some point, and mm-hmm. Beast wants to find out because he's getting all, you know, incel about where is my girl.
Right.
So he goes off and he thinks the best way to find out where she is to beat the crap out of a guy and choke him with a phone cord.
Yes.
Because, yeah, that's what Beast does.
It's not in character.
No, not at all.
And there's this horrible moment continuing the plot. So, yeah, eventually Dazzler goes back to this thing and, you know, and she, as you said, like her powers are starting to get really out of control, and the mind control they're doing on her is leading her to be more and more bloodthirsty, right? Mm-hmm. And this ties in with our talk about Beast's character. So Beast finally finds her, right? And he walks into this dressing room. She's getting ready for the night's entertainment.
Oh, yeah.
She is dressed in a Native American costume.
Like full on. You know, it's not even a costume. It's just like, it's like sexy costume.
Right. It's sexy Native American woman.
Yes. Even the village people guy was like, no, tone that down a little bit.
Right. And so her and Beast argue, and then he smears makeup all over her face, or lipstick all over her face.
Yeah. He basically,
he assaults her.
Yes, he does. He said, oh, is this what you want? Is this you want to paint your face up? And then he draws on her face with lipstick. That is, I had to put the comic down at that point. I was like, what is this?
I mean, some would accuse us of reading this with 2020 eyes. And I don't mean 2020 vision, I mean the year. Although you could make a, right. But you know what? I don't think, like, I was 13 when I read this the first time. I probably didn't get it. All 13-year-olds are incels, to a point.
Put that on a t-shirt.
But I think if I can't think as an adult reading that, even in 1985, I would have been like, oh, that's cool.
No, that wasn't okay back then. That's just straight up abusive behavior. And it was that way in 1985, and it's that way now.
Yeah. So accusing us of like trying to look back and revise, you know, I would buck against that if anybody would attempt to do that, because that's not okay ever.
Especially when it's a beloved character. Yeah, a lot of people are going to say, oh, it's just a comic book. No, no, no. It's a beloved character doing something completely
out of awful. Character.
Not just out of character, it's just awful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, and this is the parts of it, and these things exist. Beast is a creeper.
He like, is.
Through this whole thing, it's really gross. His character is awful.
And anytime someone like kind of throws eyes at her, he wants to, I'll beat you up.
Right.
It's just awful. And
it's very frustrating. There's nothing. You can find redemption in some of the characters in this, right? I mean, you could find redemption in, you know, Horsey Guy and Mr. Horse and Ms. Green.
in the kitchen with a lead pipe.
Even Dazzler has a redemption of sorts. She kind of finds herself a little bit, although her path there is ugh. That's the official literary phrase for it, ugh. Yes. You know, but there is nothing good about Beast.
No, he's really bad. Yeah, he's really, there's no redeeming qualities to him in this story.
He is the star.
Oh, yeah.
He's the X-Men Avenger Defender. You know, I mean, Dazzler was a character that existed, but, you know, Beast is supposed to be the draw to this. And we see superheroes go through arcs, you know, and sometimes, you know, Tony Stark has had his famous ups and downs, and, you know, Reed Richards, you know, is he really a good husband? You know,
a good husband? That's a stretch.
Ooh.
Hey, how you doing? You know,
we see this, and it's normal. Like, good writing allows characters to ebb and flow in terms of their likability, and, you know, characters have their dark periods, they have their redemption series, all of that. That's fine. But there's nothing here. I mean, this is just, it's just Beast as a douche.
Yeah, that's a perfect word for it. He's a blue douche. I remember that 50s crooning song, The Blue Douche. My little blue douche. The Beach Boys song.
But so we get that scene, right? And then so Beast gets drugged. So he gets captured and drugged. So after he shows up and smears makeup and lipstick all over Dazzler and abuses his girlfriend, you know, he wanders off to do something, some bit of offstage business, and he gets captured. And then they drug him. And so we go to the gladiator ring, right? And then they're presenting, you know, we have a new feature for our crowd, you know, the salivating crowd waiting for violence and whatever. And that's where we get the Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, one note here. Whoever, for this gladiator ring, whoever the set designer and props guy is, kudos to them, because on the fly, they created a whole, like a cave and a forest and a gown.
Very impressive.
Very impressive. That person deserves a raise right away, because
and I think
did all that on the fly.
If we learn anything from this comic, it's that set designers are the unheralded heroes.
Absolutely. Yes.
In life.
Continue. I'm sorry.
So of course we parade it out, and you know, they give the crowd the actual Beauty and the Beast. It's Dazzler in the dress, the Beast coming out drooling. And, you know, kind of he's lost his mind, and he's a beast who's going to kill this beautiful damsel. Or worst case scenario, and there's another subtext going on throughout all of this, which I think I don't want to hit too hard because I'm not sure how, and I don't think it was intentional, but I think it exists. And it is the, you know, the beautiful white woman and the the other.
Right.
And the other, which naturally is a beast driven by lust and carnal and violence. I'll leave that hanging there unless you think we need to talk about that more, but I think that exists.
No, it's there. I don't know if it's intentional or not, but there is an underlying subtext of possible sexual abuse throughout this whole thing that just makes everything icky. That's what I said at the beginning. Like, there were choices made, and why were those choices made? Because you don't have to have that to tell this story, but right. It just has this bad feeling. It's like you just want to take a shower when you finish reading this thing.
Yeah, yeah. But then Beast and Dazzler fight a little bit, and then she comes to her senses and he comes to their senses, and they don't kill each other, and the crowd's disappointed. So then we have they're like, oh, a big battle royal. And so then there's a big fight scene during which, of course, our friends from the Heartbreak Hotel, minus the flower woman, Link and Poltergeist show up to help save the day. Of course, Link is in blackface.
I would, yes, it does have that impression, but it is a Harlequin.
Yeah. It's a Harlequin thing. I understand, but Harlequin has issues.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
Here nor there.
Yes.
And people are going to be like, Brian's real sensitive today. So Link and Poltergeist show up to help save the day. And so there's a big battle, and Beast and Dazzler and Poltergeist and Link are fighting against crazed mutants who are part of the underground gladiator thing. And Alexander Flynn is leading them all, kill them all. And, the crowd's going crazy because they want blood. And meanwhile, Dr. Doom, who's been watching all this from Latveria, has finally come.
Yeah, he's got the closed circuit feed from from this underground fighting ring because why not?
And so
maybe it was on pay-per-view. That was all the rage in the mid-80s.
It was.
Yeah.
And so he manages to get from Latveria to Hollywood in a couple minutes.
He is Dr. Doom. I would not put it past him.
He is Dr. Doom. And so then he's lingering somewhere in Coliseum or whatever it is, watching everything. And eventually the good guys win, because then Horse Face Rider Rocker Max guy switches sides.
A little bit of nuance.
Evil is defeated, and Alexander Flynn is beaten down.
First you have Hugo, what is it? Hugo Longride. Hugo Longride. He gets killed by the gladiators, but it turns out he's a Doombot.
He's a Doombot.
Because of course he's a Doombot. Why not? Watching it. I read that and was like, what? How is he a Doombot?
It's when he gets killed and Doom can't see what's going on anymore that he takes the 5-minute flight from Latveria to Hollywood to be there personally.
And Alexander Flynn, of course, has to put on a really ridiculous villain outfit at the end.
Which is like Galactus meets Doom meets, Maddox, Jamie Maddox. What is his, the multiple man?
Multiple man, exactly.
There's a little bit of that. Anyway, and of course, so it turns out, Alexander Flynn gets beaten down and he's laying there, and then Doom walks out and does the scold that we talked about earlier. He's like, you suck. You're no son of mine. I could kill you, but I'm not going to, because it's better that you live in shame.
Exactly.
And then he walks
away. Go to your room and think about what you've done.
Right.
I mean, Flynn's plan, as I see it, was to create a small troupe of theater performers with mid-level combat training to overthrow a country by a magical science dictator with a fierce, loyal population. The guy that the entire Marvel Universe could not defeat, but he thinks a bunch of, underground gladiator fighters. That's not a good plan.
No.
It's so because of you, Dad. I did this because of you.
I learned it from you.
That's right.
So, you know, the good guys win, and then Dazzler and Beast break up.
Because they have to go on to their own comics. You can't have this continuing. We also did forget they were actually chained by their feet at one point in a dungeon.
Oh, right, hanging upside down. Oh, that's when Horse Guy...
switches sides, yeah.
Switches sides by releasing them. But yes, they're hanging upside down, facing each other, and then they have to kiss.
Yeah, then they start making out, and it's like, do you think this is romantic? Because it's not. It's actually kind of creepy and weird. Yeah, so that's kind of my feeling on this whole comic. This whole four issues is just kind of creepy and weird.
Creepy and weird.
So Beauty and the Beast, creepy and weird.
I do have to point out that the art by Don Perlin is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, you know, this is pre-Women in Fridges, but the male gaze is strong in this one.
The male gaze is strong with this one.
I mean, it's just how many shots of Dazzler's ass.
Yeah, there's not a lot I can say about the art. It's very workmanlike.
It's very workmanlike with,
with some questionable choices.
With some questionable choices. And the less said about that, the better, really. But there's a reason some of the art of this time period is held in contempt. And there are a lot of examples in this for that.
Yes, indeed.
Again, like you said, the positives. I do like the Lincoln Poltergeist relationship. And it's one of the good things that comes out of it.
Yeah, I mean, this is also, I don't know if it's particularly well done, but it's also a commentary on fame and how fame changes you, and it pulls you away from what you really want to do. Because Dazzler just wants to, you know, perform. She just wants to entertain the masses, but she keeps being manipulated by the industry.
And the onus of the anti-mutant thing that was going on in Marvel Comics is very strong here. It's kind of the impetus in some ways for how Dazzler gets herself into this situation, or Dazzler is forced into this situation to begin with. There's a scene where Beast and Dazzler are on the beach, and you know, it has the sort of, it's ham-fisted, but it's also the people on the beach all being offended and, you know, anti-mute and everything. It's an attempt at commentary. And of course, we all know that mutants, particularly as Chris Claremont wrote them, were allegory to other types of civil rights issues in the world. So, you know, the attempt is there. The desire was there, I think.
Yeah. I can't say anything bad about Anne Nesenti. I think she's really trying. She's trying to infuse, you know, something good into this real turkey of a story.
Yeah. And I don't know, we don't know how much editorial interference was involved. This was the Jim Shooter era.
Mm-hmm. I think that's all you have to say. This was the Jim Shooter era. And I have mixed feelings on Jim Shooter. I don't think he's awful, even though I've made reference to that a couple of times. But we're going to talk about more about that next week. Actually.
Yes, we will.
Spoiler.
I think at the end of the day, I feel like we could talk more about this, but I think our poor listeners have probably tuned out already. If they're still here, this is not good comics.
No,
I can't recommend it. Even to, you know, we have comics that are bad that we read because they're fun, because they're so bad. This isn't fun.
No, it's not. And it's not.
Nothing enjoyable to read here or see here. There's a reason I think Marvel doesn't talk about this comic.
Yes.
You have to search really hard to find information about this comic book.
Yeah, someone's like, no, this didn't happen. Let's move on. Nothing to see here. Yeah, it's not, this comic isn't all bad. It's just mostly bad.
Yeah.
And the mostly bad takes away any enjoyment that you would get from actually reading it.
I, I did recommend this without rereading it. We do that a lot. I recommend a lot of things where I was like, oh, I read that 20 years ago. Let's give this a try again. And sometimes we're happy. Sometimes in this case, we're not.
No, but, and I think I think that's fine. I'd like to.
I like recommending things that I haven't read in a long time. And I like it when you recommend stuff that I haven't read either in a long time or ever.
No, and again, I didn't particularly enjoy this comic, but it's an interesting part of the Marvel history, of Marvel right. Comics history, and it gives you a different perspective on what was going on.
So my apologies. Well, so kids, thanks for stopping by.
Yeah. But the covers are good. Bill Sienkiewicz covers.
The covers are great. The covers are fantastic.
Can't go wrong with a Sienkiewicz.
No. That's what the kids say. Okay, so I think we've said all we really need to say on the matter. So perhaps we should move on. And I believe, Paul, that you have a recommendation for our next exciting adventure in the Collected Edition.
Yes, indeed. Next time in an all-new edition of the Collected Edition, we will be reading Magnus Robot Fighter from Valiant. This is our first Valiant comic, which... I don't think we're going to have very many more of these, to be honest.
It depends. I mean, if we have a Valiant effort on the matter,
a Valiant effort. So anyway, we'll be discussing the first five issues of Magnus Robot Fighter. That's issue 0 through 4, because, you know, the 80s and 90s needed a zero. This is the Steel Nation arc, and it's written by Jim Shooter.
Jim Shooter!
Yes, with art by Art Nichols. It's a loose continuation semi-reboot of the Gold Key Comics run of Magnus from the 60s. And it was the flagship title to launch Valiant in 1991. It was their very first comic, I believe. I haven't done the research yet. I believe it was their first comic.
Okay. I will choose to believe you.
Sure. I'll say it with confidence. It was their first comic in 1991. Yeah, so it should be interesting. Yes, it'll be an interesting discussion.
Just like the one we had.
Yes. No, I don't think it's bad, but I'll let you decide.
Well, I look forward to reading it.
Excellent. All right, so that's it. Anything else to say there, Mr. Brian?
I do not.
Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. Please let us know if you liked Beauty and the Beast. Let us know, because I'd like to know why. Really, honestly, I'd really like to know why. So hit us up at collectededitionpodcast.com. You can leave comments on individual episodes, Twitter, at collectededpod. That's collected EDPOD. And yeah, basically, just keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at @collectededpod. That's collected, EDPOD. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
In 1985, with the publication of Beauty and the Beast, history officially died. It was not a pleasant death.
Bravo, bravo. I'm sorry, continue.
Written. I'm sorry. Okay.